pull up a chair. There's an airplane hanging in the EAA Aviation Museum here at Oshkosh, and if you walk in out of the July heat, out of the roar of the flight line, into that cool quiet where the light comes down soft on all that fabric and metal, you'll find her. Silver. Slab-sided. A cowling like the nose of an artillery shell, no windshield up front, not one. And a name painted on that nose that every soul in this country knew by heart 100 years ago. The Spirit of St. Louis. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Taildragger, and this is the Hangar coming to you from the showgrounds at Whitman Field during AirVenture. And today we're going to sit with one airplane and one young man and one very long night over the water. Now, before we push the throttle up on this story, let me tell you today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up if you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And brother, if there was ever a flight that deserved a coin, it's this one. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. So let's set the scene. It's the spring of 1927, and there's a prize sitting out there that's been driving men half mad for 8 years. A New York hotel man named Raymond Orteig had put up $25,000. That's the Orteig Prize. And the terms were simple and brutal. Fly nonstop from New York to Paris, or Paris to New York, across the open Atlantic. Nobody had done it. Plenty had died trying. And I want you to understand what that ocean meant in 1927. There was no weather radar, no long-range navigation, no talking to a controller who'd vector you home. You had a compass, you had the stars if the clouds gave them to you, and you had dead reckoning, which is a fancy way of saying you pointed the nose where you hoped land was, and you flew for a day and a half, and you found out if you were right. The big names all wanted it. There were multi-engine airplanes being built for it, big crews, famous polar explorers, backers with deep pockets. And into all of that walks a skinny 25-year-old airmail pilot from the Midwest that the newspapers hadn't even heard of yet. Charles Lindbergh. Now here's where it gets interesting. Everybody else figured you needed a big airplane. More engines, more fuel, more crew to spell each other on a 30-plus-hour haul. Lindbergh looked at the whole problem upside down. He figured every engine you add is another engine that can quit and kill you. Every crewman you add is weight, and weight is fuel, and fuel is the whole ballgame. So he wanted the opposite of what everybody else wanted. One engine, one man, one wing, the lightest, simplest flying gas tank he could talk somebody into building. He got a little group of St. Louis businessmen to back him, that's where the name comes from, and he took his idea to a small outfit out on the West Coast, the Ryan Airlines Company in San Diego, and they built it 60 days near enough. They practically lived in that shop. The airplane they made is called the Ryan NYP. NYP, that stands for New York to Paris, and she carried the registration NX211. Let me paint her for you, because she's a strange bird when you really look, and you can look because she's right there in the museum. She's a high-wing monoplane. The wingspan got stretched out longer than the standard Ryan because a longer wing carries more load on less fuel. Fabric over a frame, that barrel of a cowling wraps around a single air-cooled radial, a Wright Whirlwind J5C, putting out around 223 horsepower, that's it. 223 horses to drag a fully loaded airplane off the ground and hold it in the air for a day and a half. And the fuel lord, the fuel, Lindbergh wanted the main fuel tank up front, ahead of him, for safety in a crash. That's smart. But it meant the tank sat right where a windshield would go, so the Spirit of St. Louis has no forward-facing window, none. Lindbergh could not see straight ahead out of his own airplane. Think about that. He flew across an ocean, and to see forward he had a little periscope he could crank out the left side, or he'd just yaw the nose over and look out the side windows. That's how he taxied. That's how he landed. Sideways, essentially. Because he'd rather not see forward than burn to death behind a gasoline tank. The seat's a wicker chair. Wicker, like a porch chair. Because it's light. There's no radio. He left it home. Wait. He didn't even carry much in the way of navigation gear beyond the basics. Charts, a compass, and his own two hands. He famously didn't pack a big lunch either. A few sandwiches. Somebody asked him about it, and he said something like, "If I get to Paris, I won't need any more. And if I don't get to Paris, I won't need any more either." That's the kind of cold, clear thinking that got a man across the Atlantic. So let's get to that morning. It's Long Island, Roosevelt Field, May 20th, 1927. It had been raining, the field is soft, muddy, and there's a low overcast hanging over everything. The other big-name teams are sitting on their hands waiting for better weather. Lindbergh slept maybe not at all. He'd been up most of the night, and then the weather looked like it might just barely break, and he made the call. Now picture this airplane. She is so heavy with fuel, she's barely an airplane anymore. She's a gas tank that would very much like to stay on the ground, somewhere north of 5,000 pounds. That little 223-horse engine has to get all of it flying off a soft, wet field. He starts the roll, and it is not pretty. The tail comes up slow, she's bouncing through the mud, throwing up spray, and the far end of that field is coming at him with telephone wires beyond it, and she is not ready to fly. She is not ready. And then at the very last of it, she staggers off, mushes into the air, clears the wires by a matter of feet. And then he turns northeast, out over the coast, out over the gray water, and he's alone.
I want to stay in that cockpit with him for a minute. Because this is the part the statue and headlines version leaves out. He is by himself in a loud, cramped, vibrating little cabin for 33 and a half hours, roughly 3,600 miles of open North Atlantic. Fog, ice, he climbs to get over weather and finds ice building on the wings, and ice is death. So he comes back down and skims low over the waves, close enough to feel the spray talking to him. And the enemy up there isn't the engine. And it isn't even the weather, it's sleep. The man had been awake for something like a full day before he even took off. Now he's grinding through a second night in the air. And your body, when it's that tired, it starts to lie to you. He wrote later about the hallucinations, shapes in the fog, voices, feeling like the airplane was flying itself while some other part of him watched from outside. He'd catch himself drifting off with his eyes open and snap awake with a wing dropping. He flew that whole night on the ragged edge of a place most of us never go and come back from. And here's a thing I love, a pilot's thing. That airplane was built a little bit unstable on purpose, a little twitchy, because Lindbergh knew that a rock-steady, hands-off airplane would let a tired man fall asleep and die. A twitchy one keeps nagging at you, keeps you flying it. That airplane's own bad manners helped keep him alive. Now, the process, the airmanship. Dead reckoning across an ocean. He'd worked out his heading changes ahead of time, plotted on the great circle route, and he flew each leg on time and compass and prayer, correcting for a wind he could only guess at from the look of the white caps below. No feedback, no fix, just faith in the arithmetic he'd done on a chart back on solid ground, and the arithmetic held. After a full day and a night, he sees fishing boats. He drops down, throttles back, hollers out the window, "Which way is Ireland?" As you do. And not long after, there it is. The coast of Ireland, rising up out of the sea, and by his own reckoning, he's within a few miles of where he meant to be after 3,000 miles of empty water. That right there is one of the great feats of navigation in the whole history of flying. A tired kid with a compass and a chart, dead on the money over an ocean. He crosses Ireland, crosses England, out over the Channel, and into the night again over France, following the lights toward Paris. And he's thinking, in his exhaustion, that maybe a few folks might turn out to see him land. He did not know. Le Bourget Field, outside Paris. There are, by some tellings, 100,000 people jammed around that field. Cars stacked up for miles, headlights everywhere, so many that he circles down, not even sure that's the airport because of all the light and movement. He sets that airplane down, sideways looking as always, 33 and a half hours after Long Island. And the crowd breaks through every fence and every line of police and swallows the airplane whole. They damn near tore his clothes off, carried him over their heads. He'd left New York an unknown airmail pilot, and he landed in Paris, 33 hours later, as the most famous man on the face of the earth. One engine, one man, one wing, a wicker chair, and a periscope.
Now, that original airplane, NX-211, the real Spirit, she hangs in the Smithsonian in Washington. Been there for generations, and rightly so, but walk into the EAA Aviation Museum right here at Oshkosh, and you'll stand under a full-scale Spirit of your own. And I'll tell you why that matters, and why it belongs here of all places. Because everything about that 1927 airplane is everything this organization stands for. A guy with an idea nobody believed in, a small shop building something the big money said couldn't be done, doing more with less, one engine when the experts said you needed three. Simplicity is a kind of courage.
That's the homebuilder's creed. That's what fills these showgrounds every July. You walk the rows out there right now, the vintage rows, the ultralights, the guys who spend 10 years in a garage, and every one of them is a little bit descended from a skinny kid who decided the smart way across the Atlantic was the simple way. And when you stand under that Spirit in the museum, look at that blank nose, no windshield, and understand that isn't primitive, that's a decision. A cold, clear-eyed choice by a man who thought the problem all the way through and was willing to fly across an ocean looking sideways to get the answer he wanted. We don't build them like that anymore. Some days I miss it, but
But then I walk the flight line here and I see a fellow's home built with some crazy elegant solution he dreamed up at his kitchen table, and I figure the spirit of the spirit is doing just fine. Much of what I told you today comes from Lindbergh's own account of the flight, in his book, the one that carries the airplane's name, along with the folks at the EAA Aviation Museum and the National Air and Space Museum, who've kept this story and these airplanes in front of us. If you're on the grounds this week, get out of the sun for an hour and go stand under her. You can find more from us over at radiohangar.com. 33 and a half hours all alone, and he never once could see where he was going, and he got there anyway. Chew on that the next time you think you need more airplane than you've got. I'm Tail Dragger, Blue Skies.